Natural Living with Gary Nall, Mondays and Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting from our studios in New York City and video streaming over ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Today, we have a full show, and we're including you in because I always find your calls, comments, insights, and thoughts and questions interesting and constructive. My guest in the second part of our program is Professor Tom Engelhardt, and we're going to talk about the United States is no longer the good guys, and our policies are contributing to the Middle East problems, including the protest. What about the U.S. military and its defense budget? Why can't we cut it and save the teachers, the firefighters, the police officers, the social services people like sociologists, the people who are on the front line of helping everyday people? Why cut them when we can cut all that pork? If you had a 100-foot chainsaw, you couldn't cut through the pork ladling the Pentagon. We're going to talk with him about that. And by the way, he's one of America's most important commentators on America's military adventures and their impact upon our culture and economy. He is the founder of the Nation Institute Progressive Blog, TomsDispatch.com, and a co-founder with Steve Frazier of the American Empire Project. And also joining them would be Noam Chomsky and Chalmers Johnson and Michael Clare. That'll be in the second half of our program. We've added something new to our show, and it's called Issues. And what I've done is I've selected something that is not, I underline, not being discussed by the mainstream or even alternative media, and certainly could not be discussed from a more humanistic or progressive point of view because they don't touch this topic. Today, American Hypocrisy in the Middle East by Professor Paul Craig Roberts. Things have to change in order to remain the same. It's a very short commentary, under 2 minutes, but then I'm going to open up our lines for you to call in and give your thoughts on it. Time permitting, the International Monetary Fund protection racket. How we've made other countries poor, and now we're doing the same thing here. The latest on health and healing. We have a lot to share with you. Let's begin. I'm opposed to the Obama healthcare program for a lot of reasons. Not the least of which is I believe in universal coverage, and I don't believe we should compromise on it. I believe that when you had a democratically controlled Senate and House and White House, and yet they failed on this, they didn't fail because they didn't have the support, they failed because they didn't have the will, and therefore they were deceptive. I believe that until their families have been in a situation of going broke because they couldn't afford a medical coverage, and they couldn't afford the disease they have. And for a number of years, the number one or number two cause in any given year of bankruptcies, personal bankruptcies, health care costs. That's only one reason. Secondly, and most profoundly, there's no health in the health care bill. Now, maybe this is just the way people in Washington think, a unique way of living in denial. Shouldn't you have something in this bill that actually promotes wellness, prevents disease? But there's nothing there. Now, for those of you listening to this program over the years, 33 years and 6 months without a single break on Pacifica, the longest running daily program in the history of Pacifica, you know that There are good quality scientific studies supporting healthy lifestyle choices. Just on vitamins and minerals alone, on their chemistry, efficacy, and safety, there are over 500,000, over 500,000. Ask the average physician, they'll say, vitamins? No, they don't do any good. There are no studies. Yes, they are. Which shows you the profound lack of even basic curiosity, let alone what would they do if they found that a study or series of studies show that by taking a nutrient or changing their diet, it would do more than the medication they're used to giving. Would they actually stop the medication and change? Highly improbable based upon our knowledge of human nature. But there's one other thing in this bill that really bothers me. Well, there are a lot of things, but this really, really nails it. And instead of giving my opinion about freedom of choice, something that we have fought long and hard for, I'm going to quote Dr. Len Saputo. He's been on this program. He's a medical doctor, and he's board certified. This is a short commentary from him, only a page long. And when I read it, it reminded me of the time that I came outside of my office, and there was a woman sitting there, and she said, "Can you help my husband?" I said, "Who's your husband? And what? Why does he need help?" "Well, he's in a chain gang, breaking rocks, incarcerated for a long sentence down in California." I said, what crime was he accused of or convicted of?" "Fraud." "And what was the fraud?" "Treating people with cancer using nutrition." I became interested in this case, and I looked deeply into it and found that his only crime was that he did not use chemotherapy, surgery, or radiation. Instead, he took patients who were under the care of other oncologists. He never told them not to use these therapies. And instead, he built up their immune system by getting them to change their diet and exercise, de-stress, and take supplements. There were 281 patients of his who showed up in the courthouse to give testimony on his behalf, how he had never misled them. He had helped them. They felt better. Their immune system was better. The judge would not allow them, not a single one, to give testimony. He said to the jury, if he did not use existing standard of care, then he is guilty of fraud. Now, interesting, because some of the jury's statements later was that we felt really bad because clearly the guy did no harm. He didn't harm anyone. He didn't profit from what he was doing. He didn't promise cures. And if we had heard the patients, we would have saw that he did a lot of good. But their instructions were, did he do the standard of care? And the answer was no. Therefore, he was guilty. So an honest, ethical man who had never had a problem, who wanted to show people what would happen by helping their immune systems, but also fully aware that they were taking chemotherapy and radiation and not disproving of any of that, went to prison. I got involved. We helped, had a whole letter writing campaign, and finally Governor Brown released him from prison. That was good. But then dozens and dozens of doctors, Dr. Halstead, all these Dr. Gordon, all these other doctors said, we're also under constant harassment because we're not using standard of care. In New York State, every single doctor practicing holistic medicine was brought up in by the state to have their license taken away. In many cases, like Carl Humiston, they succeeded. In the state of Washington, or the state of Oregon, with Dr. Janice Keller Phelps, who had been the president of the Pediatrics Society of the state, but shifted towards a more holistic way of supporting breastfeeding instead of formula, they got her license as well. She ended up being a house painter. Quote, a core principle of what we call health medicine is a patient's right to freedom of choice and the right to know. Whom are we kidding when, because of monopolistic medical practices, patients are not informed of all the treatments known from evidence to benefit their condition, especially alternative medicine and natural healing treatments? What's the point of extending insurance to all Americans if they're blocked from making choices outside today's allopathic sick care paradigm? America is the land of the free, yet the public is largely unaware of the state of affairs relating to medical freedom issues. Most people are shocked when they learn, for example, that it is a felony, I repeat, it is a felony in California for a medical doctor to prescribe a nutritional therapy as a treatment of cancer for cancer. The only legal therapies permitted for the treatment of cancer in California are surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. This flies in the face of all logic and voluminous scientific literature. Under our current system, some therapies must be administered against people's will, despite religious or personal beliefs that may be different from mainstream thinking. Health authorities can and do take children from their parents when certain therapies, even toxic therapies, are refused. They can be placed into custody of the state, put into foster homes, and forcibly administered those therapies deemed to be essential to life, like the case of the HIV-positive children is a clear example of that. Similar tactics occur with respect to certain types of cancer when they afflict children. Not only is treatment with chemotherapy mandated by law in these cases, but also alternative therapies are forbidden by law. A case in point is a cancer of the brain that is poorly responsive to surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. These unfortunate children almost uniformly die within a few months to a couple of years with or without treatment. Yet parents usually have no option except to go along with often traumatic mainstream therapy. What makes this more tragic, it is well evidenced in far less invasive alternative therapies actually help these children in the natural world, but they're not allowed to use it. Now, all of us would agree that our medical authorities are well-intentioned individuals who are motivated to help us, not to hurt us. But what if, after you had researched an alternative or natural therapy intensively, you preferred to use that therapy instead of what was required by law? You and your child or loved one would be out of luck. That's why freedom of choice is high on the agenda of health care reform and could even raise to the level of constitutional right. Genuine freedom in these matters means greatly expanding publicly funded research into alternative and natural medicine. Full disclosure to patients of all treatments supported by science and insurance coverage for all such remedies, and not just for treatment supported within a disease care paradigm marred by conflicts of interest, corruption, graft, greed, and questionable or unethical science. The entire population of this planet has survived over millennia through the use of traditional and indigenous medical remedies, and 80% of the world's people still do. These practitioners learn from generations of practical experience about how to treat whole persons. They develop natural treatments in the context of their view. On the other hand, we look at what we're given today, and there is no promotion in the current legislation of laws of lifestyle strategies like diet, exercise, adequate sleep, stress reduction, weight control, avoidance of toxic exposures, securing emotional and spiritual balance in your life, non-invasive complementary and alternative services like acupuncture, herbal medicine, chiropractic, body work, homeopathy, energy medicine are essential. They're not in this. Natural medicine approaches based on the latest biomedical advances like orthomolecular medicine, functional medicine, bioenergetic research medicine, not allowed. Very careful and sparingly use of pharmaceutical drugs or surgery when needed, yes. And sometimes the patient has progressed all the way to the point that the last line of defense is clearly indicated. Finally, having access to a broad-based, carefully managed, integrative setting gives doctors and patients a larger repertoire of options and the freedom to choose what works. And that is from Dr. Len Saputo, board-certified internal medicine. And that's some of the reasons why I'm opposed to this existing bill. I believe it was the worst of all possible scenarios. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Thank you.
just got an invitation through the mail. Your presence requested this evening is formal, a top hat, a white tie, and tails. Nothing now could take the wind out of my sails.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. We're going to be getting my guest up now, but he's going to be standing on hold and just listening because I think he would find your comments about our issue of the day important. So Tom Engelhart will be with us in a few moments. But here is our commentary of the day on an issue that I think is important that does not get attention. And I would like for you to tell us what you think. And because we're heard all over the United States, not just in certain locations, please call us from anywhere. And I'll give you that number just after this commentary. This commentary is from Professor Paul Craig Roberts. He was an editor at the Wall Street Journal and Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under Ronald Reagan. It's short. It's only about 2 minutes long. I'll quote it. The hypocrisy of the United States government is again demonstrated in full bore force. The United States government invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, laid waste to much of the countries, including entire villages and towns, and massacred untold numbers of civilians in order to bring democracy to Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, after Egyptians went to the streets demanding Mubarak must go, the U.S. government remained aligned clear up to the last moment with the puppet Egyptian ruler, even suggesting that Mubarak, after running a police state for 30 years, is the appropriate person to implement democracy in Egypt. On January 30th, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton declared, quote, freedom and democracy. America neither seeks nor supports the ouster of the Egyptian dictator. Israel Prime Minister Netanyahu told the U.S. and Europe that criticism of Mubarak must be curbed in order to, quote, preserve stability in the region, unquote. By stability, Netanyahu means the unimpeded ability of Israel to continue oppressing the Palestinians and stealing their country. Mubarak has been, for three decades, the well-paid enforcer for the U.S. and Israel, sealing off Gaza from the outside world and preventing aid flowing into the occupied territories from Egypt. Mubarak and his family have become multi-billionaires, thanks to the American taxpayer and the U.S. government. Both Republicans and Democrats do not want to lose, or did not want to lose, their heavy investment in Mubarak. The U.S. government has long corrupted Arab governments by paying rulers installed by the U.S. to represent U.S.-Israeli interests rather than the interests of Arab peoples. Arabs put up with American financed oppression for many years. But now, in virtually all of the 22 Arab League countries, there are signs of rebellion. The murderous American-installed dictator in Tunis was overthrown by people taking to the streets. It had nothing to do with religion. It had to do with hunger and loss of jobs. Rebellion has spread everywhere. These uprisings might succeed in ousting puppet rulers, but will the result be anything more than the exchange of a new American puppet ruler for the old? Mubarak is gone, but whoever takes his place is likely to find himself wearing the same American harness. What dictators do is to eliminate alternative leadership. Potential leaders are either assassinated, exiled, or imprisoned. Moreover, anything short of a full-fledged revolution, such as the Iranian one, leaves in place a bureaucracy accustomed to business as usual. In addition, Egypt and the country's military have grown accustomed to American support and will want the money to keep flowing. It is the flow of this money that ensures the purchase of the replacement government. In conclusion, because the U.S. dollar is the world reserve currency, the U.S. government has financial dominance and the ability to financially isolate other countries, such as Iran. To break free of America's grip, one of two things would have to happen. Revolution would have to sweep the Arab world and result in an economic unity that could foster indigenous economic development, or the U.S. dollar has to fall as world currency. Arab disunity has long been the means by which the Western countries have dominated the Middle East, Without this disunity, Israel and the United States would not abuse the Palestinians in the manner in which they have for decades. And without this disunity, the U.S. could not have invaded Iraq. It is unlikely that the Arabs will suddenly unite themselves. The collapse of the dollar is more likely. Indeed, the policy of the U.S. government to maximize both budget and trade deficits, and the policy of the Federal Reserve to monetize the budget deficit and the fraudulent paper assets of the large banks, have the dollar heading for demise. As the supply of dollars grows, the value diminishes. Perhaps the time is not far off when the rulers cease to sell out their people for American money. End quote. Your thoughts, please. I'd like to hear your responses. That's our issue of the day. The hypocrisy of the United States. Now, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I have it wrong, in which case I hope that you will correct me. Did we see the President of the United States or Hillary Clinton or any of our major media going on a mea culpa saying, yes, it is true that of the 22 Arab League states, 18 of those are run by despots or military groups, and we have supported them, but not their people. We have given them arms, including Saudi Arabia, with the idea of keeping them in control, where the majority of their population are Shia, they are Sunni, and they are hated by their public, but we gave them the money, they gave us money, and we gave them weapons and intelligence to keep them in control. We did not overthrow any of these people because we had a need for our military bases or oil, gas, routes of transportation, whatever it may be. So that's the deal we made with the devil. We were wrong. We shouldn't have. We can't really talk about a democracy and freedom and at the same time sponsor its demise. Oh, yeah, and let us not even mention the current uprisings in Iraq. We're not covering that in the media or the White House. Oh, and we won't disdain China for what it's done in Tibet, for what it's done to its environment, for what it's done to the Uyghurs or to its Falun Gong by using them to extract their organs in military hospitals because they are not considered human. We won't mention any of that because we're borrowing money. Did I miss any of that? Your thoughts. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. This is the section of our program where you have a chance to call in and share your point of view. We're going to take your calls right now. I can see some people getting up online. Just tell us who you are, where you're from, and we'll be happy to have you on. And let's see who we have here. I don't have a name. No name? All right. Sorry, no name or no place. I need to have at least who I'm speaking with. Then let's go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by, and we'll get his point of view on this. Again, I introduced him at the top of the show, but I'll reintroduce him at this time. He is Tom Englehart. He is one of the nation's most important commentators on American military adventures and their impact upon our culture and economy. He is the founder of the Nation Institute's progressive blog, tomsdispatch.com, and is a co-founder with Steve Frazier of the American Empire Project. That's a publishing endeavor to investigate the adverse effects of America's imperial efforts and what it does to democracy, which includes notable individuals such as Noam Chomsky, Chalmers Johnson, and Michael Clare. And Tom is the author of The End of Victory Culture, and it deals with the Cold War. In his latest book is The American Way of War, How Bush's War Became Obama's. Nice to have you with us today, Tom.
Good to speak to you, Gary.
Tom, maybe you'd like to address that. We do have some people now calling in. The switchboard is full. I thought you would find it coming on, being interesting to hear what other people thought about the commentary that I put up there as an issue, because this is not what we're hearing in the mainstream media or on cable.
Right.
And let's just see, before we go to you, because I'm going to ask you to address the same issue.
Okay, which I only heard part of, so I just heard the end of. So.
Oh, it was just about how the essence was that how can we be anything but hypocritical when we say we're for democracy and freedom and we're with you people, yet right up until the moment when power shifted, we were not for those people. We were for the dictators or the despots or the military regime in their countries that had kept freedom from them and democracy from them for decades.
Yes, okay.
All right?
Yep.
John from Fairfax, Virginia, you're on the line.
Gary, long time listener. I read an article about, can you hear me?
There's an echo, John.
everything I have is off. But let me just say this quickly. Having secret banking allows all this corruption. There was an article about the exit tax of these despots when they leave. What we need is a pre-exit tax on corruption so that none of these people can have the incentive of stocking away all these billions of dollars in secret bank accounts.
Okay, I appreciate your thoughts, John.
Thank you.
I will be asking Tom his thoughts upon our banking system, how we are confiscating Mubarak's money and Gaddafi's money now, but we were the banks that held their billions of dollars, which we fully would have known were from corruption. And if you heard yesterday's program, I talked about this echelon, this super secret information retrieval system that monitors every single phone call, and would have known in advance that the people who were lining up our pro-war in Iraq would have known that the person who was telling us we had weapons, that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, that the German intelligence already had decided that he was not reliable, and the British intelligence knew that he was not reliable, and yet our own White House chose not to interview him. Well, all we had to have done would have got the intelligence agency that had been carrying on all these conversations. We would have known all that. We would have known who was putting money in bank accounts and how much and what were the sources of drug money, illegal weapons money, stealing from government money. So I cannot accept that we have not been aware, or those in power have not been aware, of the secrets of other regimes and tyrants. And only after the fact that we suddenly show up and go, oh, my God. We just found $30 billion of Gaddafi's money in our banks. Well, we're going to hold this up right now. Oh, my God. You know, Mubarak has $27 billion in Swiss banks. How did that get there? I didn't know that they paid a president of the country that much. We've got to stop being naive about this. But anyhow, thank you very much. I appreciate it. One more call. Let's say hello to Megan from Reston, Virginia. Megan, you're on the line.
Hello, I'm a longtime listener, and I really think you're so eloquent, and I love listening to you. I just wanted to share my commentary. I married into an Iranian family, and my mother-in-law is part of a organization called PMOI, or she's a supporter of it, or MEK, the People's Mujahideen. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. But I come from a military family, so it was really interesting because there's such a kind of clash in culture with that, where my dad wasn't able to get his security clearance if he spent time with her until they investigated more further into it. But their organization is currently on the terrorist list, and I've met so many people through her that are just amazing freedom fighters for the people against the current Iranian regime. And I've been really disappointed to hear personal stories from these people about the United States government and military and how it's been, like you said, such a hypocrite in the way that it relates to this company or this organization. They took, one story she shared was they signed a contract with the U.S. military saying that they would give up all their weapons in exchange for being protected by them from the Iranian government. And they were on the Iraqi-Iranian border, and they signed a contract, and they took all their weapons, and they completely abandoned them, and they were just slaughtered by their own government. And it's just really hard to hear those sort of things, because my father is kind of, he's a good American, and he's even, I would say, consider himself a liberal, but he's, I think he's really brainwashed, you know. I think most of the people in the military think they're doing something good, and they have really good motives, but the decision makers and the people with the knowledge at the top, with all the money, are just using most of the military people as pawns and using their ignorance against them, and it's just, it's really like horrifying to find out, you know, these truths about the country that I live in. So I just wanted to share that with you, and also I wanted to get your thoughts or get some information from you. You said that the news wasn't covering what was happening in Iraq right now, and I don't know anything about what's going on in Iraq. I'm one of the ignorant masses, and I'm wondering if you could go into more detail.
Okay, please, you're going to have to hang up because of the poor connection. But Megan, we got your message. Thank you. I'm going to ask Tom to deal with why the White House, the State Department, has not been as strong in its criticism of pounding down dissent, nonviolent dissent in Iraq and Afghanistan, as it is so quick to stand beside those in other countries because it's our ally. Tom, let's take this step by step. First, would you give us your insights about why in the world do we need a $1,300,000,000,000 budget on off sites, all the other different budgets I could find put together to defend this country? And why do we need all these military bases all over the world, over hundreds in Afghanistan alone, costing us billions of dollars, and at the same time we have 17 million children going to bed without adequate nutrition in the United States, 47 million Americans on food stamps, and over 240 million Americans slightly above, at, or below the poverty level, and we can't find help for any of them. We can't stop their homes from being foreclosed on, or won't. We won't stop them from going into debt on these usurious credit card debts, but we have unlimited amount of money and no criticism for funding this vast military intelligence complex. Could you take us through this, please?
Yes. I suppose the simplest thing you could say is that Americans don't fully grasp how much the United States is a war state, a national security state, and how much Washington is a war capital. And you're referring to the I posted a piece at the website tomdispatch.com today by a military expert, Christopher Hellman of the National Priorities Project, and I had him actually go through the 2012 budget that's just been submitted to Congress by the Obama administration and try and come up with an actual figure for, you know, the full national security budget. This is including everything. It's including the $80 billion that goes into intelligence agencies every year, probably more than that, but the official $80 billion. It includes the war fighting, it includes the Pentagon budget, and so on and so forth. And as you said, the figure he came up with, and you can't find it anywhere else. I mean, it says something about our world in answering your question that the New York Times doesn't have this figure, and Tom Dispatch does. The figure that he came up with was a hard $1.2 trillion a year go into national security spending. That includes veterans care. That includes pensions for Pentagon civilians who have retired. That includes money on interest money on the money we've borrowed to fund the Pentagon in some cases, and so on and so forth. And that $1.2 billion is just a lowball figure.
A trillion.
It's just a lowball figure that really we're talking about $1.3 billion or beyond. We really don't completely know. But this is the hardest figure you can get, and it's the highest figure you can get. And you can go and add it up at the site. You just go look at the piece and add it up yourself. You'll see it's rather stunning. And I think it's evidence of the fact that, you know, I mean, we're having a budget debate right now in which we're talking about peanuts. You know, I mean, peanuts that aren't peanuts to the people who are going to get cut, as you just made the point quite eloquently. You know, I mean, if you happen to be a low-income person who's going to lose your fuel subsidy, or a woman who won't be able to go to Planned Parenthood if the Republican cuts in the House were to go through, this is not peanuts to you, but in financial terms, it's peanuts. And in the meantime, the actual Pentagon budget is going up. I mean, this is a startling thing, because if you read the headlines, it says Pentagon cuts, you know, and they're talking about cuts of $78 billion in the Pentagon budget over the coming years. But it's not cuts of the actual budget. It is the equivalent would be if you were a person, a very, very overweight person, just a bloated human being, and you decided to eat more but to cut your future dreams of what you might eat. And that's really what's happening right now. So we're in a situation where American money is pouring into what's called national defense. And when you look at the world right now, you realize that just to take intelligence, which is one of these things that I think about, you know, you mentioned Michael Clare. Now, Michael Clare is an energy expert and a resource expert. And I've followed him for years. For years, he has been ahead of the curve. He's one guy. He's reading open source information. And the military asks him to come down and talk to them because he's right. He's totally, I have a piece by him coming on oil, which is a striking piece on Thursday. He's regularly right. For $80 billion, we are eternally off the mark, you know, and I mean, that intelligence budget, if you were to wipe it out, I mean, in all 17 agencies, this labyrinth of agencies, you would be in a remarkable, you would be able to, the Washington would be able to see more clearly without what we call intelligence. I mean, much of this is really a kind of a vast, profitable scam. I'll stop. I'm sorry. I'm rattling on.
No, you're putting together some of the pieces. Now, today, there is a report from the Huffington Post, Dan Fromkin, and it says wartime contractors waste, steal tens of billions of dollars, then come back for more. I'll quote one paragraph. Quote, from 200,000 people employed by contractors to provide support and capability in Iraq and Afghanistan, accountability is too often absent, diluted, delayed, or avoided. And there are so many barriers to suspending or banning contractors with violations that untrustworthy contractors can continue profiting from government work. Reasonable responsible businesses may be denied opportunities, and cost to taxpayers will only climb. And then when I saw the amount here, it's just staggering. We're talking about $200 billion. Well, if you took all of the 50 states' budget deficits that they're fighting over in Wisconsin, every other state right now for, they're going to have to do a lot of cutting and hurt a lot of people in the process. If you just took half of that, $100 billion, you would wipe out 90% or 85% of all the states' budget deficits. Yeah. And that's only money that we're getting nothing from these corrupt contractors. They even showed where the Pentagon is giving some contractors money three times over, meaning paying them three times for the same project, or giving three different contractors to do the same identical work. The redundancy is mind-numbing, because every general who was at the Pentagon, who's now a private consultant, has got their own pet projects, and sometimes these are competing projects where they've given three or four different generals who were formerly there in a powerful position, they're giving them all this money. The public doesn't know any of this.
Yeah, you know, we used to have a term for this when we were talking about other countries. We used to call it crony capitalism. But, of course, it's us, so we don't use terms like that. I mean, I'm always struck that we're in a situation where, you know, like just across, I live in New York City, right across the way in Camden, New Jersey. A dangerous city. They're cutting the police. I mean, they've cut the police force in what, half, something like that. Now, in Afghanistan, distant Afghanistan, we are putting 11, I think this year, I mean, I don't have the figures right in front of me, but I'm pretty close, I'm sure. We are putting $11.6 billion into training the Afghan police and security forces. We're building barracks for them. We're building schools for them. It's expected that we could spend up to $12 billion on the same thing next year. This is, by the way, in the 9th or 10th year of training the Afghan police and military, who, having been trained, unlike the Taliban who were fighting, basically don't fight. You know, so what I'm always struck by is that in the United States, we no longer talk about stimulus packages for anything. I mean, this is now out. You know, the stimulus package, that was old news. But if you go to Afghanistan, we still have a stimulus package. Over in our war zones, we have a stimulus package. A Marine lieutenant can go into some village in the south of Afghanistan. He can hand out cell phones. He can pave roads. He can rebuild the bazaar. He can build a school. I mean, you go to some town, you know, at the edge of Providence, Rhode Island, you know, I mean, all over the country, towns would love to have money like this to do exactly the same thing. I think that the argument that this is making us more secure rather than less secure, on the face of it, is ridiculous. To be doing this fruitlessly in a desperately disastrous war in Afghanistan when we're taking this away from people here, when our very, I mean, the thing that strikes me, and you're completely right about the utter and deep corruption in that war machine, that war state machine. The other thing is, you know, that I'm always struck by is, you know, the aging infrastructure in this country. I mean, we are putting no money into, we're not putting in money into dams, we're not putting it, which are now at the edge of disintegration, we're not putting money into natural gas pipelines, which are exploding all over the country. We're not putting money into bridges. You remember the one that went down in Minnesota. I mean, we are not investing in the sinews of this country. That would seem to me to be the definition of genuine security. I mean, if you really look at terrorism, which is the thing that drives everything in this country ever since 9/11, if you look at the what terrorism has done in or to this country since 9/11, it's just above. I've looked at these figures. It's just above shark attacks. And what we demand of terrorism, because it's very profitable to demand this, and it makes the worst state in the national security state one, we Americans seem to demand utter safety, 100% safety from any guy getting on a plane with anything. But on things that actually do us in, E. coli bacteria, to give you an example, we don't demand utter safety. Cars in the street, we demand anything but utter safety. I mean, the very standard we use to keep the war state running is a standard we would mock on anything else in America. Not only mock, but we don't use on things that actually kill significant numbers of Americans. I think this is it's a remarkable state, and we are in terror over. I mean, 9/11 was horrible, but other societies have lived through nightmares like this. Also, terrorism cannot take down a society, period. It can't do it. You know, but we can take ourselves down, and since then we have done a remarkable job, I think, of shoving ourselves over a kind of a cliff.
I appreciate those insights, Tom. Two points, if you could connect them, please.
Mm-hmm.
One is that historically we have been looked upon by most of the world as the good guys.
Mm-hmm.
But today, because of our very specific support for the tyrants in the Middle East, or 99% Israel, 1% Palestinians, we have imbalanced this perspective. Now, now that the people are not, because of Glenn Beck's claiming they want a new caliph coming, no, that's nonsense. It's because people are hungry,
right,
and educated people, including lawyers, are selling fruit in order to buy bread. One lawyer in Tunisia said that he was a lawyer, he is 33 years old, he was working every day selling fruits so that he could buy enough bread for his family. He had not had anything other than bread and grain in his meals for over 4 months. And he said that's why he was in the streets. It had nothing to do. All these people are Muslims. I mean, you're talking about 300 million Muslims. It's not about being a Muslim and taking over the world and putting in a new supreme ruler. It's about work, security, food security, the things that could have easily happened if they used properly the money that we have given them. But we gave them weapons and took their cash instead of giving them the help to rebuild their schools and sustainable living and reforestation. We gave them none of the tools they needed to sustain a population in a healthy way. And I believe that we, in effect, gave them a hand grenade in each country, pulled the pin, and told them to keep holding it together. Now it's not possible. So I see that in virtually all these countries, the last probably being Saudi Arabia, because it's the most fierce and it cares the least about what the world thinks of its actions against its people. But I think that you're going to see a lot more regimes fall. And when they do fall, I see a whole lot of new young people coming into power who are going to look at the United States, who are not unaware, and say, hold on a second, don't tell us you're our friends. Don't say, oh, we're with you. Where were you for the last 30 years? And therefore, the image of the United States has changed, and reality becomes that perception, and we have changed the perception. And lastly, in the Middle East, if I was Israel, and I want to see peace in Israel, I'm going to see peace for the Jewish people and the Palestinian people. But my goodness, what do you think you're doing by taking the land, continuing to build, putting people off their land, having people live in what amounts to apartheid prisons outside, the largest in the world, and then expect these people not to be angry? I can't imagine any more foolish way of approaching solving a problem than what is being done up to this point. But that's my own personal views. I'd like to hear yours, Tom.
It's huge, isn't it? It's almost hard to know where to start. I would start on the issue of the way in which we've changed in the world, and not just in the world. We've changed at home too. You know, I'm now heading towards 67 years old, and when I grew up, you know, this was seen as a can-do country. I mean. If something went down, we did rebuild it, here at least, you know? I mean, the truth is, we now go abroad preaching good governance and, as you say, democracy, but nobody believes we have good government or really democracy here. Nobody believes things can be rebuilt here. I mean, they aren't being rebuilt. And it's very striking. I mean, the basic view, I mean, and I think Americans, you know, when I was a kid, nobody would have talked about the government as, say, the bureaucracy. I've heard young people have talked to me about this. You know, I wouldn't go into the bureaucracy. I dreamed as a kid of going into the government. This has all changed here. In the meantime, abroad, as you say, I mean, we've backed, I mean, in the Middle East, where all this is happening, we've backed every two-bit dictator, and some who weren't so two-bit at all, you know, including the Saudis. And we've done it all for a single reason. I mean, the world is a complicated place, but, I mean, it's completely clear that the Middle East was the global and the American gas station, you know, and what those rulers promised, it didn't matter what they did in their countries, what they promised was oil. They promised copious oil, which is what's kept our part of the world going. You know, and we were willing, in fact, we were eager to have autocrats of various sorts, control those countries, I mean, Mubarak-type autocrats, as long as the oil flowed, as long as the Suez Canal stayed open, as long as the oil flowed out of the Saudi fields. And, in fact, the Saudis have just increased, they've increased, I think, their per-day oil production by about 700,000 barrels to partially make up for the Libyan oil that's just gone offline. So the Saudis are still doing this. And in the process, of course, we did, as you say, stop being the good guys. So that when you look, I mean, right now in the Middle East, it is, and it's an incredible moment this way. I think it's actually a world historical moment. Whatever is happening in the Middle East, and we don't even know what it is yet. I mean, it's too soon to fully know. But nonetheless, it is Arabs who are inspiring, even in this country, even in Wisconsin, they're inspiring protests, they're inspiring calls for democracy, all the things that we thought we possessed. You know, this was our patrimony. Well, I have news for you. It isn't anymore. And when you look at the Middle East to this day, I mean, we are still supporting in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, in Oman, and so on and so forth. We are still supporting the autocrats. It's totally clear. I mean, the only time we don't support them, as I think you said at the end of the last half hour, is when they fall. And then we scramble and claim that we support whoever else is there, the Egyptian military, whoever it is.
Tom, give us your idea about what lessons does the American public have at this time in history, seeing what's happening in the world. By the way, most people got the story of what was happening when we were backing the dictatorships in South America, mm-hmm. in Central America, Somoza, and all the and Pinochet, and intentionally destroying democratically. If we didn't like the democracy that you elected, then we went after you and we disabled it. And we even tried with Chavez, and that didn't work. Talk about what message we have to get out to the American public today about the larger world issues.
Well, I think that from my own point of view, you know, I mean, many of the things that I've just mentioned would be, to me, crucial. I mean, I would like Americans to know as a start that $1.2 trillion-plus dollars of their tax dollars are going into this national security state, that that's really where their money is going. I mean, huge amounts of it. Everybody talks about, you know, Medicare, everybody talks about Social Security, but all of which help actual human beings. But this is just money going into the war state, and it's getting worse, not better. So, I mean, that would be lesson one. The second lesson would be that when we're out there in the world, we are supporting. You know, we talk democracy out of one side of our mouth, but we don't support actual democracy. We don't support democratic movements. That's not what we're for out there, in the places where it actually counts. And I think in the end, you know, that is going to be part of our undoing. In addition, we've continued to prosecute distant, hopeless wars. You know, year after year after year, which offer no genuine security to the United States. And as you said when we started, we continue to garrison the world. And when we start thinking about cutting, we never think seriously about cutting the part of what's expensive for us, which is our garrisons around the world, our wars around the world. Nobody talks about lowering the American global military mission. And I think sooner or later, that has to make it into the forefront of the American mind. It has to become a major part of the debate, and it has to start to happen. And the sooner it happens, the safer we'll be.
Tom, thank you very much for being with us today, and hopefully people will take the time to read The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's, or go to tomsdispatch.com. All the best to you, Tom.
Thanks a lot. It's Tom Dispatch, by the way, no S, tomdispatch.com.
Tom Dispatch, okay.
Okay.
Thanks
so much, Gary. Bye.
Bye. Back to your calls now on any topic, health, nutrition, issues. I'm going to spend the remaining 4 minutes of our program talking with you. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. That's why we like to deal with the issues here on this program that make a difference and are just not discussed in the mainstream or the cable media. Until your calls come in here, which will be coming in a minute, a few health and nutrition points. GABA, G-A-B-A. Now, that's gamma aminobutyric acid, and it's a very important nutrient. Here's the latest on it. If you're feeling stressed, well, you're not alone, of course. The fact is, most people are stressed or irritable or anxious, nervous about something, and you don't want to end up taking something that is not good for you. The GABA is very important. It can help you calm down, slow down. It helps calm the firing nerves in our central nervous system. It's a neurotransmitter, and in most of us, it should work just fine. For most of our lives. But if you end up with a deficiency, it stimulates the pituitary gland to produce the human growth hormone also. So for men and women, if you don't want to lose your muscle mass, make sure you're getting your GABA every day. And it's also responsible for helping us produce those wonderful mood-elevating endorphins. And so if you're lacking the correct amount of this compound, you might experience manic behavior, anxiety, recklessness, seizures, things we call bipolar, all this is possible. So take about 500 milligrams of GABA a day, G-A-B-A. From Virginia, let's say hello to... I can't pronounce the name. Is it Virginia from Virginia? Am I getting that right? Virginia, please listen over the telephone because there's a delay. Please pick it up. No, we're going to have to try another call here. Sorry.
Wanted to let him know that if the contractors complain about we're going to starve to death, they're not. They can live off of their retirement.
Okay.
So if you just put that under his nose.
Well, you just put it under all of our noses. Thank you very much, Virginia from Virginia. We'll take another call here. I'm just trying to get as many in as I can. Maybe I can get one more in here. Sam, you're on, Sam. Sam from Virginia, what's your issue, please? Speak up. I'm sorry. Can't get any more up here. We're having a little technical glitch getting people up. All of our lines, every line's lit, and I think they just jammed each other. All right, we're coming up to the end of our program. I thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more. And remember, for any reason you can't listen to something or you don't hear it, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com or GaryNull.com, G-A-R-Y-N-U-L-L. We have all the current calls to actions. We have hired scholars who are doing the latest papers on genetic engineering and vaccinations and alternative treatments for AIDS. If it's important, we're on it, and we're creating original papers and documentaries. And so go to those sources. It's all free. It's there to help you. Have a nice day, everyone.
Like the beat, beat, beat of the tom-tom when the jungle shadows fall. Like the tick, tick, tock of the stately clock as it stands against the wall.
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.
You, night and day, you are the one. Only you.